And welcome back to another episode of The Conspiracy Skeptic. I'm your conspiracy skeptic, Carl Maimer, and I have a returning guest, Karen Stolzno. Karen, sorry, Dr. Karen Stolzno. If I can call you Karen, is that okay, Karen?
Of course, Carl.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And you were on last October 2016. We were talking about the conspiracies of Australia. Yes. If you look at my output, it was, you were kind of the penultimate guest before I took my quote, little break. The last one was episode 76, Rigging the U.S. Election with Nigel St. Whitehall. This was shortly before the November 2016 election. And then for reasons, I didn't really pick up again until, 4 years later about. So,
I think we all needed a break, but thank you so much for inviting me back on the show.
Yeah. And been a lot of changes. And part of it's about the book you've written recently that I want to talk about. Which is, hang on. Sorry, I have it right in front of me. But I don't know the title page. Let me bring it up again. And I got asked, did Blake Smith, your monster talk co-host, did he help you with this title called Misconceptions?
You are not the first person to ask me if Blake came up with that. No, I came up with that pretty much based on experience, all the myths, conceptions that I had, and misconceptions too about infertility. And I grew up with a father who punned as much, even not more than Blake. So,
okay,
that explains how I'm capable of my own puns.
That explains how you get through every show. Now, I managed to harangue my way onto Monster Talk a number of months ago, which was kind of a lot of fun. And and then I think I got through the whole episode, and I'm like, I don't think Blake even made one pun during my show. And then I was like, it's one of those where you're both relieved and extremely disappointed. But when I did listen to it, I did realize, no, he did make a couple puns, but you know.
Yeah. Sometimes they end up on the cutting room floor. So, fair enough.
Yeah. But, I'll say that. Yeah. I mean, I'd written my first book,
That's right.
Yeah, the Skeptics Book of Lists, and then you and Blake talked about it. And I will tell you, that was great for book sales. I must have sold like 7 or 10 copies that month, which
is an achievement for independent publishing. Absolutely. So I'm glad we're able to help out.
Oh no, it was great. I think I did. Not to say like you should. Every time you have me on, I'm sharing a bit of wealth with you guys. But no, I think I did PayPal you guys a portion of my income, book income for that month, you know.
Oh, well, thank you very much. But no, congratulations on the book. It's a long journey, quite like mine for this book.
Yeah. And then you were sort of talking about your misconceptions, and it's about sort of your own personal journey. Okay, you have a son, Blade.
Blade, yes, that's right. He's 8 years old.
Wow, yeah. So it's kind of about your journey having him, and it's really hard to talk about infertility without talking about it in a negative, but your part of your book is about like, we got to stop this. You know, this is, you know, in many ways it's like, you know, we have to sort of just sort of accept that, you know, some women can have children, some men can have children, you know, other couples can't. And, you know, let's get beyond that, you know, it's not treat it like it's, you know, but when you do decide you want to have a child, right. But yeah, so sorry, but I'm explaining your book. Why don't you explain your book?
So the book basically came out of my own infertility journey. And so what I do is I kind of set that as a backdrop, talking about my own experiences against the history of infertility, because we tend to think, oh, infertility's really only been around since the time that IVF came about, which is about 40 something years ago now, back in 1978 with the birth of Louise Brown. So a lot of people think, oh, infertility hasn't been around that long. Of course, it's been around since the beginning of time. And we have anthropological objects like the Venus of Willendorf, or now known as the Woman of Willendorf, which is one of the oldest basically fertility symbols, or the oldest antiques around. And that was, it's about maybe 30,000 years old. And that was discovered about 100 years ago. And it's a really touching testament to how long infertility has been around, how long this has been a problem. And if you go back through books and records, as long as there has been writing, people have been talking about infertility. So going back to ancient Greece and Rome and the Babylonians, they all had their own creation stories and ideas about infertility and how that came about. And interestingly, a very long history going back thousands of years for not only the diagnosis of infertility, but the treatment of infertility. So obviously we're not talking about the kinds of assisted reproductive technologies that we have today, like IUI or IVF, but certainly they had their own methods for investigating this and attempting to treat it. So I really delved back into the history of all of these kinds of things and found that it was really chock full of science and just interesting facts about how we've looked at infertility, how we've talked about infertility, and the things that we've done to try and cure infertility. And it's just a really fascinating history. So whether you are someone who is child-free by choice, or you have children, or you're going through infertility, you probably know someone who's going through infertility. You have a relative or a friend. So it's really something that touches all of us. And it's certainly, if it's not touching you personally, it's something to have empathy about for other people, because this is a worldwide problem. I think there's about 4% of women in the United States who face infertility, and around 1 in 6 couples are going through infertility. And it's believed to be about maybe 100 million people worldwide who are going through infertility. So there's a lot of discourse about it, but a lot of different opinions about infertility as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really like about your book is, I mean, you are very open about your journey.
Too much information.
Yeah, you will learn things about Karen that you're like, should I even be reading? And Matt, you know, your husband, should I even be, you know, it's like, you know, my temperature is at certain temperature. Matt, get over here now.
CMI with this, but by necessity, there has to be. I mean, you know, we're talking about a very personal thing that there are a lot of euphemisms for talking about fertility and infertility, but I to go into my personal story, I had to talk about my diagnosis and my surgeries and then Matt's surgeries. And so we really had to delve into things that are icky and more information than you think you'd want to know about me. But I think it resonates and has resonated with a lot of people who are going through this. So really, once you have to look into infertility and see a reproductive endocrinologist, you have to leave a lot of things at the door. You were talking about the most personal things that that you can talk about with doctors and nurses. And you really have to get over it at that point.
Oh, yeah, but that's the great thing about the book, especially, I think, you know, if someone is, you know, sort of has infertility and they're trying to conceive, that you know, you're very frank. And it there's a lot of people who must have a very hard time talking about this, just not with their doctor, but, you know, their wife, their husband, their family, you know, friends.
Oh, yes.
And you know, being able to read your openness can help, I think, people be as open, you know, and like, I don't have to be shy about this. You know, this is just by odds, man, you know, but then, like, what I love, you then intersperse it with, like, going back to looking at the history. And, you know, because this is a conspiracy show, at first you're like, well, I don't think my book really has anything conspiracies. I'm like, oh no, there's so much, like, you know, conspiracy stuff behind, I mean, just the idea, you know, like, you know, the sex of the baby, right? I mean, it's actually the man who's, maybe I got this wrong, but I've always assumed it's actually the man's contribution that determines the sex of the baby. But, you know, but women have always been traditionally been the ones who like are to blame, you know, if they, you know, they don't produce a son, right? You know, what is,
oh
what,
yeah,
yeah. Do you encounter that?
Yeah, so there was a tablet that was discovered that's about 4,000 years old, and it was talking about a marriage contract, basically, and stating that if the wife could not conceive, then she would allow her husband to take an enslaved person as a surrogate so that he could have male children and to consider to continue the family name. And all of those things that are, you know, have always been important to people. So, this idea that women are the ones who are infertile goes back thousands of years. So women have always been blamed for this. And I think it wasn't really until medieval times that people started realizing, hey, it could be the man.
Yeah.
So, I mean, some terrible things have happened to women who have not been able to give birth, especially those monarchs, the wives of kings, and sometimes they've been exiled or sent to a convent, and in a couple of cases even executed. So yeah, women have always carried that burden, but research shows that it's pretty equal when it comes to men and women in terms of infertility. So if we look at couples, typically it could be about one third of cases it's the woman's fault, although I don't like using that term to say that the woman is facing infertility. In another third of cases, it is the man who's facing infertility. And in another third of cases, it's both the man and the woman. So that's what was going on in my case. It was a combination of things that I was going through and a combination of things that Matt was going through as well. So it's really unfair to talk about blame, but certainly it can be a woman or it can be a man who has various issues, and those need to be tackled and dealt with before you can attempt to conceive. So it's a really long journey. A lot of people think, well, why couldn't you have done this earlier? Because it took me, I went through this for about a decade. And, you know, people think, well, surely this is the most natural thing in the world, but you find out very quickly it's not. There are a large portion of people who face this, and it can be any kind of disease or issue. And it really takes a long time to get to the source of the problem too, because I was talking to people initially, just attempting to get pregnant. And then it gets to a point where infertility is considered to be, scientifically, is considered to be a year of attempting pregnancy without getting pregnant. And if you're over the age of 35, then at that 6-month point, if you haven't conceived, then you're considered to be infertile. And I mean, there are a lot of other things too. If you can't carry a baby to term, that can be considered infertility. But it really just takes so long. You're trying for so long. I think it's been estimated that a couple will try some 75 times to get pregnant before they're successful. So it can really take years. And if you go and see a doctor under the age of 35, like I did, they're going to say, well, there's nothing we can do. We can't test you at this point. You just need to try. So you're really sent away and dismissed at that point. And so we went through a huge journey trying different things. Now, I've got a long history of being a skeptic, but also being a guinea pig. Going back decades ago, when I worked with the Australian Skeptics, I went into a kind of Mata Hari position of going undercover and trying all different kinds of alternative medicines.
Okay.
So we really did that in the process of trying to get pregnant. We looked at faith healing. We looked at different herbs and tinctures and supplements. We obviously ended up going with the medical route in the end, and that was the route that was successful. So I'd certainly urge people who are listening to this show who are going through infertility to get to a gynecologist or to get to a reproductive endocrinologist or a urologist for a man as soon as possible to try and find out what's going on. But I think there's just a lot of naivety when it comes to fertility. As I talk about in the book, when we're going to school, we're taught about abstinence. We're taught don't have sex. You're going to get pregnant a woman's going to get pregnant the first time, or girl, the first time that she has sex. So you need to be careful of these things. So you don't know that you have a biological clock. There's a social clock as well. And you're really on limited time. The best time for a woman or a girl to get pregnant is really around that time where it's stigmatized, when you're a teenager or you're in your 20s. And then the social clock comes into play as well. There's been a lot of research into that, where people think if you are over the age of maybe 35, suddenly you're deemed to be too old to mm-hmm. have a child. And you look at cases like Janet Jackson, who gave birth to a boy at the age of 50. And so that was considered to be a geriatric pregnancy. But it really feels for women like there's no right age. You're either too young or you're too old. There's just no perfect age to get pregnant, to have children. People will always judge you. So you really have to ultimately do what's right for you and listen to yourself and not worry about what other people say. It's difficult, though.
You know, you're speaking about that that ancient marriage contract, and I thought to myself, you know, not so ancient. I years ago, I knew this woman, and she came from a she married a man who from a very, very rich family, and she was basically given a contract from the family that said, for every girl you produce, you will get $10,000. For every boy you produce, you will get $100,000. And she ended up getting divorced and not producing any heirs. But that's still, have you heard stories like that?
I haven't heard any stories within my crowd of friends and other people that I know, but I certainly could imagine that kind of thing taking place. And so even though we're talking about this contract that was written, you know, thousands of years ago on a tablet, a clay tablet, certainly there are people nowadays who still look at things that way. And certainly historically, through to today, people will value having a boy over having a girl. And a lot of people place a lot of emphasis. There was a case I write about, I don't remember all the details, but it was in India. And the grandparents, well, not grandparents, well, the parents of a couple sued the couple for not having grandchildren. Jeez. And they were that upset. So you get all kinds of stories. I mean, truly, there's a lot of interesting stuff out there and cases. And even though you think, oh, this is strange, this is unique, this is all part of the human experience. So it's probably more common than you think.
I mean, culturally, there are definitely a lot of cultures, right, where it is like, you know, you got married, now produce grandchildren, like, you know, your parents.
It's an expectation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm kind of lucky that my parents could not have ever given a fig about whether I produce grandchildren or continue the line. I married a woman who has a daughter from a previous marriage. And so, you know, all our resources are just going to raise her. And so when we got married, you know, the first thing out of my mouth is like, the Mamer line dies here. So, you know, my sister had a child, but, you know, he took his father's last name. And then my brother married a woman with two children from previous marriage. So and then my aunt and uncle, they have had no children. So, yeah, there's part of me is like, yeah, this line just dies out. And I was, you know, the last hope. But I mean, no one was ever like hoping, but you know, I kind of love that the Mamer line dies here. But
and that's great that you are, that's how you feel, because I think for some people that's a devastating thought, and it's something that they feel they can't live with. And I think that being child-free is a lot more popular nowadays. And probably since around the 1960s, 1970s, our birth rates in Western society have really plummeted, and there are more and more people who are deciding that they don't want to have children. Instead, they might have four-legged children, furry children, right. And that's fine. I mean, each to his or her own, that's absolutely the case. But, yeah, for a lot of people, there's just that expectation that once you get married, and I do write about that at the start of the book, that people assume there's this kind of period maybe for a year or two after you get married, and everyone was constantly looking at my stomach to see if I had a baby bump and asking me, well, when are you going to have children? And it's something that I heard from Matt's side of the family not so much from mine. I've had lots of interesting conversations with my mother where she said, oh, you never wanted children. And then also said, oh, you always wanted to have a boy and, oh, you wanted to have a girl. So which is it, Mum? I think because I decided to have children a little bit later in life over the age of 30, I think a lot of people assumed that I was going to be child-free, that I didn't want to have children. But I do remember that moment that baby fever struck and I had gone to it was an Amish farm. And this was in Idaho. And excuse me. I remember just seeing this child there and the child was so cute. And I really felt this tugging of my heartstrings that it was time to have children. I wanted to have children. But I really think before then, it was something I kind of, excuse me, took for granted. And I thought, I'm going to have children one day when the time's right. When I've got the appropriate finances and when I'm in a relationship, when I've finished my education. So, of course, I've got a PhD. I was going to university for 10 years. So it's really something that was on the back burner for me, but I thought I'll get around to it. My body will be ready. And I just didn't think it through very much. And I think that that's very common. I think, again, it goes back to the kind of sex education that we receive at school. We're told don't have sex. We're not told about ovulation, we're not taught about fertilization, we're not taught about how we have children and when that is the appropriate time to have children. So none of those things are taught. So you really just think, okay, well, I have the equipment, I'm going to be able to conceive someday. So it's a kind of naivety.
When I did get married, my wife and I were kind of talking about, well, do we want to have a child? And it, for me, it was kind of the opposite, where I'm kind of like, I started to do the math. Like, I got married at age 50, first and hopefully last marriage, age 50. And, and I'm like, I started to do the math, you know, and I'm like, and I realized that, you know, I'm going to miss out. Like, I may live to see my child graduate high school, go to university, but, you know, I may miss her getting married, having her first child. I will be long dead before my child hits these other markers. And however much I love this child, I'm always going to look at that child and think, like, there's so many major milestones in your life I'm not going to live to see. And that, I didn't know if I could handle that, you know. But we just sort of decided, let's just raise Leah. That's her.
Right, and I think those are absolutely considerations that people should have. Matt was 47 when Blade was born, and then you look at, and I think that this really affects our perception of fertility and infertility as well. When we look at cases like Janet Jackson having a baby at the age of 50, and when we hear about all the rock stars and celebrities having children in later years, you look at George Clooney, well, he was 55 when he and his wife had twins. And then you look at someone like Paul McCartney, he's had children in later years, Steve Martin, and of course, Mick Jagger. We always have to refer him when we talk about having children. He has, I think I'd heard recently he'd had another child, but I couldn't verify that, but he certainly had a child when he was in his early 70s, number 8. And there was the fellow from The Odd Couple, I can't remember his name, he had a child in his 70s.
Jack Klugman.
We'll have to fact check that one. But absolutely, those are considerations when you think about that. I mean, for me, having a child, so I was basically 38.
Okay.
37 when I got pregnant, 38 by the time that Blade was born. And I couldn't really allow myself to worry about that too much. Right. Nowadays, how do I look at things? Well, I'm going to be as healthy as I possibly can, barring any genetic issues. I see the doctor and have my annual wellness checkups for everything, gynecological, just basic physicals. I exercise every day. I take really good care of myself, because I want to do what I can to be around for him for as long as possible. And but I totally respect those who say, well, I think I simply feel that I'm too old to have children or that I won't get to see these milestones. But it really, in my case, it was like, it's now or never. I have to do this at this age or I won't do it. And so it was just, I had that drive to do that. And you're going to say something.
I was going to say, I mean, part of your book too is just, I think it's like, I mean, this happens a lot of things, but just right, all the people come out of the woodwork with, you know, and I'm doing air quotes here, advice. What was some of the worst advice or don't worry, you know, you can just adopt a dog or like what's some
yeah.
of the-
Oh, well, I think it ranges from people actually trying to help and giving you advice through to real microaggressions where people mm-hmm. are saying things like, oh, the world is overpopulated anyway. And right. I did, unfortunately, when I went through IVF, I've gone through IVF a number of times, more than I even discussed in the book, and had some terrible experiences and had miscarriages. And this the horrible microaggressions that people would say along the lines of the world's overpopulated anyway. Just a mean, nasty, lacking in empathy kind of thing to say. But certainly there's a lot of folklore out there, and people don't really understand the basics of how you conceive. And I've been told that I should take certain supplements and certain medicines, like Lydia Pinkham's vegetable compound, which is a tincture that's been around for a couple of hundred years, right. Through to people saying, drunk and have sex in the back of a car, basically equating getting pregnant with young people, I guess, being irresponsible. So, of course, young people tend to get pregnant more easily, but there's a biological reason for that. It's not for folkloric reasons, but certainly people saying have sex during a full moon or have sex in the missionary position, that's the only way that you'll get pregnant. Right. Drink cough syrup as well, because it can kind of thin the mucus in the mm-hmm. the cervix, and that is actually used and recommended by some doctors too for men who might have thick, gluggy sperm. Because if you're a man who has to undergo infertility testing, they'll basically test your sperm, they'll test your sperm count, mm-hmm. they'll look for things like motility, which is movements, and morphology, which is the shape of the sperm. And sometimes sperm can be very thick in terms of volume, and so they'll tell you to drink cough syrup because it can thin out the fluids in the body. But there's just a wealth of advice out there, absolutely, as you referred to, just adopt. So that's there've been lots of excuses for infertility or reasons for infertility going back over time. People who went through infertility were blamed for it and told, well, you've thinned, you've somehow disappointed God, that you wouldn't be good parents, perhaps you're cursed by God, that kind of thing. Then through to more psychological understandings of infertility, and people would think, well, if there's a moral reason for you not getting pregnant, or maybe the woman truly does not want to get pregnant and she's resisting pregnancy. And of course that's not the case at all. I've lost where I was at.
Bad advice.
Bad advice. People saying that if you adopt, that the woman will then suddenly relax, she'll no longer be so scared or concerned about getting pregnant, and it will happen easily. And so that's happened to a friend of mine. He was adopted, and then his parents got pregnant with his brother. And so when people have these kinds of anecdotal evidence, these personal experiences, even for skeptics, this person's a skeptic, it can really weigh very heavily on your mind. And you think, well, this happened to me, this is how things are. Mm-hmm. Certainly adoption is another suggestion. And this advice really goes back a very long time that people have believed. And I had people tell me that I should take progesterone, like in the form of yucca plant, various supplements and things. I mentioned the Lydia Pinkham's mm-hmm. tincture as well. So, you'll get all kinds of advice from people. And especially if they have had children, they feel like they're experts. They feel like they're knowledgeable. but the advice isn't always very good or scientific.
Yeah, exactly. Back during my like childless days, my mantra was always, I have no children of my own, but I have all kinds of ideas about how you should be raising yours. Just to remind myself that, you know, like, don't be that guy, you know, don't be that person. Like until you actually have a child, you do understand, right? Like, you know, you are the ultimate armchair quarterback. And have you found this that you know, that your idea of motherhood and the reality of motherhood are
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'll have to preface this by saying that actually getting pregnant and then carrying to term, going through birth, motherhood are very separate things to infertility. I was tempted so many times to talk about my experiences in those areas, but it just wasn't germane to talking about infertility. So once I actually got pregnant, wow. I mean, I do not go into in the book, but I really suffered morning sickness. I was terribly sick. For the last 3 months, the last trimester of my pregnancy, I was on a host of different medications because I could not sleep. I had a situation where I took some Afrin for a cold, and a lot of women get, so I can't think of what it's called, something like pregnancy rhinitis, but it basically means a blocked nose. And I couldn't breathe through my nose for months. Mm. So I took some Afrin, and I've got a thyroid condition, leaning on towards hyperthyroidism. So I was very sick and just could not sleep. I was thoroughly, thoroughly miserable throughout my pregnancy. I had a lot of aversions to various foods and smells. And then I had a lot of really strange cravings too. I could not get enough of peppermint. I remember going into a supermarket and they had bath salts, so not the Florida kind, but just regular bath salts. And they had a big tub of this kind of peppermint-scented one. And I just stood over that for maybe about 20 minutes, just breathing it in like a psycho. I was just obsessed with that. I loved the smell of petrol as well and the smell of rubber tires. And so it was just really difficult going through pregnancy. I'm trying to avoid using swear terms, but it was really difficult. And all the things that people told me, things that people told me were nonsense too. You know, people have very good experiences and others have terrible experiences. And, you know, people would tell me too that maybe things were harder on me because of my age. And that's not really true. It was just, Matt would always talk about infertility and say, don't worry about other people and what they've gone through, because their infertility is not your infertility. And that turned out to be a very wise thing. And I could absolutely apply that to pregnancy too. So my pregnancy is not the pregnancy that other people have. And certainly now the experience of motherhood is a different kettle of fish again. And, you know, I had, because I'd gone through that 3 month period of insomnia, and then I gave birth. And of course, we're talking about feedings every 2 hours after that. I had people say to me, you won't sleep for the next 18 years. And I was really at the point where I was tearing my hair out because I was not getting sufficient sleep. Yeah. And that was nonsense. It was certainly difficult for the first few weeks, the first few months, the first few years in different ways. But then you also have just people giving you advice about children, and people always try to kind of categorize everything and talk about just various stages and periods in a child's life, those first few weeks and months and years from infancy through to toddlerhood. You know, people just always will talk about their personal experiences, and you certainly have a lot of similarity across people's experiences. Again, these are the human, this is part of the human condition, so there is going to be a lot of similarity, but a lot of these things too are real tropes. You're talking about the terrible twos with kids, and we went through a very difficult stage. For us, the terrible twos started at maybe about 18 months.
Okay.
And we had some issues with overstimulation and concerns about autism as well. And so just the advice that was coming from people about what to expect or how things should be wasn't very helpful because their experiences were different to ours. So we really had to go through and do the hard yards, do the work ourselves. And certainly at this point, now that he's eight, he's very healthy. He's doing really well. He's excelling at school and everything has absolutely been worth it. And it's a big trial to go through everything we went through. I mean, most people go through pregnancy and then having the children, they don't go through that infertility to begin with. And that really does deplete you financially as well. You were talking about the expense of having children and just focusing on that. Well, it's incredibly difficult to not even be able to get to that stage and to have to spend thousands to tens of thousands of dollars. I've got friends who've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars going through infertility, having to go through adoption, having to go through surrogacy. That's another reason why adoption isn't for everyone. It's an incredibly lengthy process. It can take years. There are a lot of hurdles, financial, legal, social. It can be very difficult. A lot of people are turned away from adopting. And yet a lot of people will treat you as though you're selfish to not immediately adopt. There are so many kids who are needing homes. It's really not that easy. It's very restricted nowadays. It would have been easier going back to the 60s and 1960s and earlier than that. But it's a difficult thing to do. And certainly adoptees go through a lot of issues for being adopted.
Yeah.
And so it's not as cut and dried as people think. You really can't judge people until you've gone through it yourselves or listened to their story.
Yeah. I sort of came onto the scene when my daughter was, she's about two. So, you know, the nice thing about marrying a woman with a child is, especially when the girl's two, is a lot of the hard work has been done. And you can also kind of go like, this kid's a brat, I'll move on. But, you know, you can sort of see that. Like, and I just feel it's like this is the best two for one deal ever, right? You get a wonderful wife, you get a wonderful daughter. And all
oh you're package. Very fortunate.
Oh yeah. And so much of the hard work has been done. But I always tell other parents, I'm like, especially when they're newborn, this is my one advice to them. It's not, you know, you're not gonna get any sleep. It's like there'll be a day when your child can wash themselves, can dress themselves, can get food out of the fridge, and can work Netflix. And then after that, so much your job is done. It's like when they become these little independent little bots, there's that one. It's like, wait, I don't have to tell her how to use Netflix anymore. I don't have to pour her milk from the fridge, you know?
Oh, yeah. And you know what? That's a really sobering time as well, because you can think, oh, it's a relief. In some ways,
it
is a relief to stop having to change diapers or nappies, as we call them, the Australian English term. But at the same time, there's a sense of loss. That last time that you need to change the child's diaper, and then they're potty trained, they can do it themselves. There is that sense of loss. And I will admit, about a week ago, Blade was having some applesauce, and there was a little skerrick left in the bottom of the bowl, and I fed it to him. And I just felt such a wanderlust for those days, and just such nostalgia. And it is true. You really have to cherish those times. You go through a lot of difficulty, a lot of lack of sleep. And I mean, you're really giving yourself over to that child and dedicating yourself to them and their needs. They come first. They're the center of the universe for years. But there is a time where there'll be that last time that you change the diaper. Mm-hmm. There'll be that last time that you feed the child. There'll be the last time that, you need to help them when they go to the potty, you know, to do all of these kinds of things that you really take for granted, or you really get to the point where it's like, I can't stand doing this anymore. And the expense of all these kinds of things too, of diapers. But you really need to cherish those days and relish them, because when they're gone, you really do view them with a sentimentality that you don't have at the time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people who are like child free, who want to be child free. I mean, they also sort of experience a lot of
Stigmo.
I'm not pretty sure if I'm pronouncing that word correctly. You're a linguist. Opibrium?
Well,
That even
I
the right
think
word?
it depends. Yeah, if people can be, and we'll have to cut this bit out because
No.
I'm thinking I can't visualize it myself right now. Let's just say they experience a lot of stigma for what they go through.
Yes.
And sorry, continue.
Oh yeah, no, I was just gonna say, yeah, the it's like, and it's just not being child-free. There's something very weird in the human psychology where, and it's like if I, Karen, if you don't like a movie I don't like, I take it personally, and it's like just the idea of like when people don't make our choices, that we get we it almost makes us feel angry or hurt,
Right.
and it can be a, right, it's just as simple as like, it's like, you don't enjoy the same movie. I love the Dungeons and Dragons movie and you hated it, like
Well, I think it goes back to a kind of tribalism, really. And I think we're always cleaving ourselves off into, we're different skin colors, we're different religions, we're different sexes, different genders, and we're constantly seeing people who are different to us as being bad. So, I mean, the anthropological view is it's just different. This is all about differences. But I know what you mean. It plays out in things like football teams. You don't barrack for the same group that I do, the same team that I do. So we're enemies, and you have that kind of rivalry. And I think it's such a shame too. I wish there was more of an intersectionality for this kind of thing, because I have a lot of respect for people who are child-free. Now, historically, they might have been called childless, and
Right.
that has negative connotations. But absolutely, it's a choice. Some people don't get to make that choice, though. There are some people who are child-free, remain that way, but they wanted to have children. Some people who have children who wanted to have more children that they had. That's the category that I fit into. And then people who have children, I'm seeing more and more articles too, with people saying, like, get pocket articles and people saying things like, I have children and the reality is I hate them, or I don't like them, or I didn't want to have children. You certainly get people who have children and they didn't plan to have those children in the way that I had to, and they're resentful because they didn't get to finish their education, they didn't get to do the things that they wanted to do, to travel, and they feel this resentment for having children. So you really have, it is a spectrum. I think fertility and infertility is this spectrum, all different kinds of views and perspectives, and I think we truly have to respect people. Then we have other people like Chrissy Teigen, who has, I think, believe, three children now. She suffered miscarriage after her first two children, and people were saying things like, well, you've got two children, why do you want to have more? I had the same thing said to me. On the one hand, you're being told, when are you going to give him a brother or sister, and that kind of stuff, people looking at my stomach after I'd had my son and thinking I was pregnant again, or making bad jokes about there being another one in there, and that kind of thing. And then later on, you have the—I mean, everyone has their opinion, and what they say about opinions are like assholes. And I think you just have to try to respect other people's decisions or other people's life paths. Everyone is different. But yeah, there's a lot of negativity that I've felt from child-free people too. And I've had friends who've seen my trials and tribulations and say, well, you're putting yourself through this, you've wanted this. And well, I don't want the grief, I don't want the pain, I don't want the suffering. So I really think we have to try and respect other people's choices and their situations, and just understand that we're talking about differences, not whether someone is better than us or worse than us, and to try not to compare our situations.
I mean, I think we are, I mean, probably maybe the last, at least the last couple of generations, at least in our various societies, people who have children are, I mean, other than accidents, are people who want to have children, that you no longer mm-hmm. have to have a child. You don't need, you don't have to have five children to get two to live to adulthood, will then take yes. care of you mm-hmm. in your mm-hmm. retirement. You know that,
yes.
that
mind the farm.
Yeah. Okay. Do you think this is good? You know, and necessarily those people are much more mm-hmm. nurturing, loving. You and Matt are so much nicer than me, because I never had a child.
Oh, and that's not true. Yeah. You love your daughter, and, yeah, no, and you're talking about her so fondly. Yeah. And but I, you know, it's really hard for me because sometimes I think I am a better mother than many, and I love my son more than other children, other parents do. And how can I possibly compare my experiences mm-hmm. to that of others? And I have to kind of get over that, get past that. Yeah. I do think that we planned him, we paid for him, we went through a lot more than the average parents did. So we really have that respect for life and view our son to be so precious and so wanted and so planned. And as you say, other people have accidents or they unwanted pregnancies, mm-hmm. unplanned pregnancies. But I really have to fight that instinct to think, you know, oh, I'm a better parent. But then I've had my son say things to me like, oh, you and dad are so much cooler than other parents and you don't ground me, you don't punish me, and you let me have all the Robux that I want for Roblox. And yes. So I do think that we're probably a bit more liberal than other parents. But really, I do think some of that is nurture, because my parents were pretty relaxed. My mm-hmm. parents growing up in secular Australia were pretty easygoing and for the most part let me do what I wanted to do. So I think I've really passed on a lot of those behaviors and have continued with those. So it's such a subjective thing, but I really strive every day to be a better parent. And to be a friend to my son and to parent with kindness. And, you know, I've never hit him. Matt has never hit him. And yet we have some horror stories ourselves about things that we've gone through, especially Matt. He had a lot of childhood trauma and abuse and some issues resultant from that. So, you know, we have to really be very mindful of that when we're raising children, that we don't pass on our own traumas and perpetuate bad things that have happened to us, because you know we're developing little personalities there.
Yeah, I mean, one of my friends that happened to him, right? He, you know, his wife is pregnant, and a couple months before her due date, he started like having all these anxieties and not to be able to sleep and stuff like that, and then he kind of realized, like, yeah, you know, my parents were abusive, right? And mm-hmm. you know, and even before the kid is born, you are loving it, right? Like, and he just assumed that he was going to be an ogre to this thing he knew he was going to love, and that was this right. dissonance was stressing him out. And then he just realized, wait, I don't have to be my parents. Mm-hmm. I can be. Right. I can break the cycle. I can be, mm-hmm. and you know, he's just this great, you know, let's go find a fridge box and we're going to make a time machine. You know, he's just this great hands-on dad, you know, and that's another thing too. Like, I mean, I don't know about your dad, but I mean, I'm from that generation, right? Where, you know, the dad smoked in the waiting room while the mom had the child, right?
And, right, yes.
And, you know, my dad was a scientist I don't doubt he loved me, but you know, mm-hmm. Dads of my generation were not very emotional, you know, and
right. You know, yeah.
And absolutely. That's kind of passed on to me. Like I find it, you know, I'm kind of more of the taciturn, you know, I'm like, hey, here's a Leah, here's a, here's a Mac Pro. I love you. You know, I express my love through giving her things, all the things I did not have a child. That's right. How I express my love, giving her those things versus just tell me about your day. Boy, that guy sucks. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, it is a weird combination of, I guess, us passing down the kind of traits and behaviors that we grew up with, and then also having that kind of attempting to not be our parents and to try to do things differently. And my father was more of that kind of school too. I mean, he passed sadly in 2020, but he was a very supportive father, but also very much in line with traditional gender roles. And so I think he had more of an affinity with my brother than with me. He didn't really know I was his little princess, but he didn't really know how to deal with a little girl. That was more the purview of my mother as he saw things. And so with my son, you know, I think I've tried to understand his interests. And even though, I mean, he really gets into, at the moment, he's interested in things like robots, robotics, and trains. He's been very passionate about trains since he was very wee. And so I've tried to let him teach me about the things that he's interested in and to try and have that affinity with him that I feel I didn't really have with my father. He was just more into the idea of, well, I'll raise the boy and woman, you raise the girl. So we don't really get into those gender roles as much. And I'm really amazed to see my son grow into his philosophies and grow into his worldview. And I just can't believe what an amazing feminist ally he's becoming and what an understanding he has of things like racism and sexism. And some of these things he's being taught at school, some of these things we're teaching him at home, some of these things he's picking up from YouTube of all places. Even an understanding of politics is just incredible to see this little human growing before your very eyes. And to some point you are molding this child and teaching them how to be or how not to be. And in other ways, they are evolving and developing themselves. So it's really a remarkable experience. I'm so glad that you get that opportunity to see that too and to experience that.
Yeah, for sure. All right. I guess on that happy note, I think we could wrap up. But so your book, let's get the name of it again. Misconceptions.
Yeah. How we make sense of infertility. Because that was my journey of trying to understand why I was going through this.
Right. and this is available at Amazon, but real bookstores too.
Yes, you should be able to get that through Barnes & Noble. And if you can't find it at your local bookstore, please do ask for it.
All right. Let's hang on. Let me just check out in Canada if it's available. Our version of Barnes & Noble is called Indigo. Indigo.ca.
Oh, never been to one of those.
Oh, yeah. It's when they first opened these like big glamorous bookstores in Toronto, I'm just used to bookstores as just being bookstores. You go and you buy a book, you leave. And then you go into these mega bookstores and I'm like, oh my God, they've actually invented a bookstore for people who don't read books. Like it was just like,
places to have they've coffee. Got so many toys and gadgets and games and other things. You're right. I mean, I miss Borders, but Borders and Barnes & Noble are very much like that. It's often more about the coffee and food and other things. And you rarely see people buying books.
They do buy books. It just really struck me. Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm saying you go into a Barnes & Noble, my local one anyway, and the coffee shop is full and you see people buying, I don't know, maybe bookmarks and plush toys and chocolates and things like that. And no one's buying books. I think people are buying a lot more online.
Well, for sure. Yeah. No, you're definitely available on Indigo. So
I think even Target and Walmart and just lots of different places.
Yeah. $36 hardcover in Canada. The ebook is $27.
That's ridiculous. I'm just having a look at what it is for me, and it's been on sale for quite some time. Let's see. So at the moment in US dollars, it's $8.30 on Kindle and $14.71 for hardcover, but it's gone down to about $3 in the past. So I think you need to kind of keep an eye on it, and it does tend to fluctuate in price.
Well, I hope the Indigo people are giving you a big share of that ebook revenue. We'll buy your book through ebook. It's $27
for ebook. I got an advance, so I'll be lucky if I ever, like a moderate advance for me, certainly. And so I'll be lucky if I ever see any profit after that.
That's true too. Yeah, the nice thing about self-publishing Amazon, it's just like money's yours. It just comes in like
Well,
$20 a month, but
pros and cons, with self-publishing, you don't have that kind of push, you don't have that distribution and the marketing that you get with.
Whereas the paper is like, first they all the printing costs, blah 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 blah, and then you make like a couple bucks per book. I mean, I could charge if I wanted to charge like $37, which Indigo's charging for your book. I make a little bit more money, but I'm just trying to like price it so it's like I get a couple bucks, you get a 500 page book, the end. That kind of thing.
Well, with publishers, they're trying to make back what they've paid for not only the advance but publishing costs, and then to make a profit on top of that. But yeah, the authors are the ones getting the rough end of the stick for sure.
Now I mean, a lot of your sort of earlier books, and correct me if I'm wrong, were more kind of like skeptical, in sort of the realms of skepticism, but you're starting to kind of branch out, into different kinds of genres. Are you gonna kind of come back and write some skeptical books, or is that kind of that's sort of set sort of done and,
Well, I think there is skepticism in all that I write about. With misconceptions, there's a
Oh
hell of a
yeah,
lot
for
of
sure.
skepticism because you're questioning folklore and things that people are telling you, and the bad science that's out there. So there's absolutely that element. I think once a skeptic, always a skeptic. So really, I do infuse critical thinking into all of my books. And it would be fun to go back to skepticism, or certainly to write more about the paranormal. I don't really feel like it pays off very well. I think that when it comes to the paranormal and supernatural, if you write about that thing from a believer's stance, you're going to make a hell of a lot more money and have a lot more success and fame than you will if you're a skeptic. It's just such a small community. And I don't really participate in the social aspects of the community anymore outside of what I do for Monster Talk with Blake. So, even though there'll always be skepticism in everything I do, there'll always be critical thinking and rationalism. I'm just not sure that I'll be going back to those days, because I think having more of a focus on language and linguistics and culture is more my interest. But certainly, I might go back and write more about maybe religion and beliefs and things like that, but probably not skepticism. It may be something with Blake someday about cryptozoology and monsters, but he's wanted to turn the Based on a True Story into a book, and I've been gently trying to discourage him from doing that because there's just very little interest in books about skepticism. Disappointing, but I'm sure you found that too.
Like I kind of say before, it's like I'm old and I wake up at 5 in the morning and no one else in the house wakes up for hours. So it's just something, to do. Like I
You're
could
not
go,
old.
yeah, I mean I could just go, I could feed pigeons, or I could just write work on a book, right? So, it's just like, so I say, like and I'm when I get $20 a month into my account for sales, I'm happy. Like I'm just happy because it's like if a magical elf left $20 on your porch once a month, you'd be like, this is the greatest thing ever. And
Like losing a tooth.
exactly. It's great. I love it. Yeah.
Well,
Keeps you
and
busy.
I totally see what you mean too. And I think if I had the resources, I would definitely reconsider doing that. But I think having to rely on royalties as my pay, my wage, at my stage of life, I think I really have to think about, I have to take that into consideration. And it's not just for love. Even though a lot of this is kind of academic, and it really does end up being for love and not money. But I have to kind of factor that in as well, And I'd just like to move beyond the skeptics crowd. I think there was a lot of disappointment there with that movement and certain individuals that are still involved. And I just wanted to break free and write more about things like linguistics and psychology. And I'm enjoying that more and feeling more satisfaction, I think, than just singing the party line.
I agree. It's the classic, never meet your heroes because you will be disappointed that,
Oh, yeah. Every time. Every time. And I'm doing skepticism with Blake. And so I feel like that's kind of my quota, and I'm satisfied with that.
There you go. Yeah. And right. So, yeah. So, misconceptions, find it in a bookstore or online. And obviously, you're from Monster Talk. That is a fantastic podcast. I always say,
Thank
I'm the
you.
podcast that wants nothing. So, I'm not asking for patron money or, buy me a coffee or anything like that. I would always sort of say, if you find yourself suddenly flush for cash this month, Monster Talk's a great podcast to donate to. I guess
Oh, thank you.
now that I kind of have a book, now I like to say, first buy Karen's book. If you still have a
Oh,
little bit
thank you.
left, you could buy my book. But so I got to kind of
Thank you.
amend that. I'm the podcast that wants nothing. But yeah. So definitely buy Karen's book first. Yeah. I my my. Oh, go ahead.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I think for years we didn't have Patreon with Monster Talk, and we just realized, especially now that we have a weekly format, that we use a lot of resources, and the show takes a lot of research, a lot of time, a lot of administration. So we appreciate the support.
I mean, I will say there was a time, especially before mortgage rates went up, there was a time when that yearly $400 hosting bill I got from my website was nothing. And now it's like, holy crap, it's $400.
Yep.
I can
Times are definitely tough.
exactly. My in-laws have moved in, so we're a household of five people eating out's not cheap, so it's like it's
Oh,
You
yeah,
don't eat out as
nothing's
much as
cheap
you do.
anymore.
Yeah, I
Oh,
know.
yeah,
So
you've got to take care of yourself, obviously, first and foremost.
know. So it's like, yeah, now I'm beginning to go like, why do people always beg for money? Like, but they can't afford $400 a month? Now I get it. Or $400 a year? Now I get it. Yeah. When you got
Oh yeah, it's
mortgage and
yeah,
kids and
certainly, yeah, certainly those expenses and just all the other expenses that are associated with running a show and all the time that you're dedicating to that that you could otherwise be spending with your family or your job or doing other
Exactly.
things.
All right. My final question is not, what is your favorite monster? My final question is, if you are at some event and someone's like, oh, you are Karen Stolzno. I heard you on the Conspiracy Skeptic. You were great. Can I buy you a drink? What are you drinking?
Oh gosh, I would have said until quite recently Chardonnay.
Okay.
So a glass of Chardonnay. And I've got a funny story associated with that. Years ago, I went to one of the amazing meetings, so one of the old skeptics conferences of yore. And I was talking with DJ Grothy from the James Randi Educational Foundation. And he said, "Let me buy you a drink. What would you like?" And I said, "I'll have a Chardonnay, please." And he said, "Oh, a shot of nay. What's that?" I guess it's my Australian English accent. But yeah, I said Chardonnay, corrected him. Had to write it down in the end, but we got there. But nowadays, I'm actually really enjoying gin, a glass of gin. So gin on
Wow.
the rocks.
Okay.
Really, I like the botanical gins and some of the fruity ones too. But yeah,
Okay.
so I like wine and gin. Can't really get into other drinks, other
Right, okay.
spirits,
Right.
but gin is a good kind of traditional historic drink as well.
Awesome. All right, Karen, I'll let you go. Thank you again.
Thank you, Carl. It's always a pleasure.
All right, have a good day there.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I can see it. The face is glowing. I can see it in your eyes. I'm happy in knowing that you're having my baby. You're the woman I love, and I love what it's doing to you. You're having my baby. You're a woman in love, and I love what's going through you. The need inside you.